Okay, we're live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, a very special guest. He comes to us all the way from Israel. His name is Ashley Rindsberg, R-I-N-D-S-B-E-R-G. And he just published a fascinating book titled The Gray Lady Winked, How the New York Times' Misreporting, Distortions, and Fabrications Radically Alter History, just published May 2021. And he's not just written nonfiction. He's also written some fictional stories. One is Tel Aviv Stories, Israeli Short Fiction from the Heart of the Middle East, published 2011. And Rivka and Rebecca, A Novella of Life, Love, and Loss in Jerusalem, published 2020. And the foreword to this book is written by Mark Crispin Miller, who reached out to me when I published one of my books. So familiar with him, but it's a very timely book, very well written. A lot of history in there as well, but talks about the New York Times and how a lot of very important events were shaped by this, but Ashley Rindsberg can talk more about that. So Ashley, are you there?
Hi, William. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for agreeing to the interview. For people who may not have heard of you, can you talk about your background and what led you to publish, or I think you self-published or started your own business to publish this book about the New York Times?
Yeah, so I've been in Israel for a while, living there, and it was there that I kind of picked up this book of history. It might be familiar to some people, which is The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by a journalist from the time, from that era, named William Shirer. And I was kind of just thumbing through it one day in Tel Aviv in a cafe or whatever, and came across this little footnote where Shirer, who covered World War II from Germany, mentioned that almost in an offhand way, that on the eve of World War II, when the war was just about to break out, the New York Times reported that Poland invaded Germany. And that really stopped me in my tracks to say, wait a second, this is just a fundamental fact. It's just truth that we know, obviously, Germany invaded Poland. That was the part of Hitler's master plan of invading and conquering Europe and the rest of the world. And I just couldn't quite understand how, first I wanted to make sure that it was true, and then B, I couldn't understand how it could be true if it was. So I went to start doing some research. I started looking through the New York Times archives, and you know, sure enough, I found out that was how the New York Times presented the story and the facts. And then I dug a little deeper, and that's where that started to open my eyes to what really happened and how deep the corruption ran in that particular instance. And when I started learning about that and the Berlin reporting of the New York Times and Germany reporting of the Times for about 10 years, then I would really had to know more. I had to know, was this just an isolated case, or was this something more endemic to the New York Times as an institution? And that kind of launched me on this search that ended up being this book.
Right. And that's, there's a lot of different chapters in there, a lot of different events, and you are up against kind of a really paper of record, a very powerful paper, right?
Yeah, the New York Times is much more than a newspaper. I mean, maybe today that now there's a little more competition from independent media, but I'd still think that even today, the New York Times really sets the agenda on what gets covered, what doesn't get covered, how things are covered. It really has a disproportionate role in shaping our reality and in almost editing our reality. And what the New York Times chooses to present as the truth is what many, many people, including myself at the time, believe is reality, not just true, but the reality that we live. And that kind of power is really what's at the heart of this book, because as powerful as the New York Times is, it's owned by a very small family. A small family that has a deep business and financial interests in many things, and it always has. And when you've got that kind of concentration of power, and power that's not related just to money, but power that's related to the way we understand our world, the way we understand fundamental truths, like who invaded who in World War II, then you've got a very problematic situation. And I think that's what people are starting to wake up to today.
Right. And you stated in your intro that a lot of people did not want or weren't interested in pursuing this topic, correct? Some publishers and other people kind of gave you a warning because of the nature of the New York Times, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nobody, especially in media, especially in publishing, nobody wants to risk angering the New York Times. You have so much that rides on their approval, such as getting onto their bestseller list, which is not their bestseller list. They consider it an editorial property, which means they choose what's on there. It's not raw numbers that determines. And getting on that list means life or death for books, for authors, for publishers. It's the difference between success and failure. No one wants to risk a bad review. No one wants to risk getting blackballed by them. And just no one wants to risk that kind of power that they have. So I was warned by some people, some in a sympathetic or friendly way saying, don't do it. Some in a very angry way saying what you're doing is sort of flies against everything that we stand for. That's something I couldn't really understand, because in my mind, my point of view, I was just telling it, just giving, trying to give a straight shot. This wasn't like a pay-in against the New York Times. It wasn't a polemic. It was trying to just present the facts as I found them, mostly in the New York Times own archive. But people had these really strong reactions, including people I didn't even know. I mean, some cases it was book designers or something. In one case, someone wrote me this scathing email, really castigating me for this. This person hadn't even read the book. Just the notion that someone would dare to oppose the New York Times was enough to really get people fired up. And at the end of the day, that's where I said to myself, we're at a real turning point in media and publishing, where people can now just choose to do it themselves, not because it's fun or not because it's easy, because it's really not, as I'm sure you know. It's because it gives you the freedom to tell the truth and not to have to water it down and not to have to contort it or twist it in order to match the interests of some third party, in this case, publishers or media outlets or whoever it might be. So that was the story behind this book. And it took me 15 years to get to that point, because when I wrote it, we didn't have these options. And now we really do. The power is returning to the hands of people like us. And it gives us a chance to pull back the curtain on institutions as powerful as the Times.
Right. And so the family, if you noted in your book, I found that interesting. They had two levels of stock, Class A, Class B. So the internal family has really decision making, and people who may have ownership really have to just kind of kowtow or follow what the Sulzberger family says. But they kind of came into ownership of the New York Times in the 20th century when so many important events were happening. And you start off your book, you talk about, like you said in the intro, this whole event in Gliwice about Germany and supposedly Poland invading Germany. Can you talk a little bit about how the New York Times, their approach to this, what led up to World War II, and some of the figures, some of the maybe celebrity journalists really shaped those perceptions in the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we start with that basic premise that this is a family, it's a dynasty, it's a very rich and very powerful dynasty. And you get to this point where the overriding interest isn't telling the truth and gathering the facts, that kind of, you know, boring old mission of a newspaper. For them, it's money, power, prestige, maintaining those things, furthering those things. And that meant doing whatever it took. So when we come back to this idea of World War II and their disastrous reporting, which went far beyond reporting that Poland invaded Germany, it included 10 years of reassuring New York Times readers that Hitler was sort of an okay guy. And it turns out the reason for that disaster was that their Berlin bureau chief, is a guy named Guido Enderes, who I talk a lot about in the book, was a Nazi collaborator. The Nazis knew him. They loved him because he reported so sympathetically on them. They gave him the goods. The Nazis gave him great sources, and they came to him with all the good information. And for the New York Times as a newspaper, that meant they got scoops. It gave them a competitive edge over the competition in the news market. And that's what they really wanted. They wanted to stay number one. The interest there wasn't about bringing their readers the accurate, dry facts about what was going on, whether they were first or second or third to get them those facts. For them, it was really about being first, staying first. And they admitted that if it meant keeping this guy, Guido Enderes, this Nazi sympathizer, as the Berlin bureau chief at the most critical juncture in American history until that point, then they were okay with it. And they even threatened to sue a junior editor who wanted to expose this guy.
Right. I mean, and you said that there were some battles in there about how long were we going to do something about this Nazi correspondent in Berlin. And I mean, terrible predictions, the what they did. I mean, we can lead into also kind of how the New York Times handled one of the most horrific events in human history, which is the Holocaust, because that their reporting on that was very questionable as well.
Yeah, you know, when you really look at the Holocaust reporting, it is it's very disturbing, I would say. It gets to that level because, you know, in one instance that was very representative of the rest of the reporting on the Holocaust was that there was a report of 700,000 Jews murdered in Europe by the Nazis. And they shoved that into the back of the newspapers. I think it was like page 812 or something like that. In a tiny little article of a couple inches column space. And on the front page that day, they had all sorts of stuff. They had a guy in Iceland who was killed, one single guy. They had something about police demotions. And that was really representative of what was happening with their Holocaust reporting, which is that they just did not report it. They did not report one of the biggest and most momentous, impactful events of the 20th century, if not of, you know, the millennium. And they didn't do it, again, because their interests in their mind were overriding. They were a Jewish family at the time. They didn't want to be seen as a Jewish newspaper because they thought that would hurt their business. So rather than covering up this world-changing event, they covered it up. And to me, that's one of the greatest sins of journalism in modern journalistic history, is the cover up of the Holocaust by the most important newspaper in America.
Right. So they were benign. I think you said they only ran stories about the Holocaust six times on the front page over that whole 6 year period of the war or the conflict. Right. And so the kind of Sulzbergers, they saw themselves more at, do you think that their outlook really influenced their reporting in the sense that they were kind of a different, they were kind of an Americanized Jewish family? Well, how would you characterize their outlook at that
time? Yeah, I would say so. I would say that, you know, they really thought of themselves as just American, which is perfectly fine. I mean, I think anyone can see themselves however they want. And for a family living in America to consider themselves as American, that's great. But when you're going so far as to deny not just your own, what others might consider as your identity, but to deny a historical reality that's unfolding in front of your eyes, then you've got a real problem. But, you know, even if there was some ideology there, and maybe there was in the background, I really think that this, like so many of the other instances that I cover in the book, was really about maintaining their financial interests, their power and their prestige, and how far the lengths that they would go to maintain those things is really what's scary.
Yeah, and you juxtaposed one of the weddings of Sulzberger's daughters with the Ponary Massacre. So you had this kind of uncomfortable reporting during these really terrible events. But there were definite New York Times shortcomings in those reportings, but they're also in their approach to, I would say, the paper's left-leaning, their approach to what the deaths that happens in Russia, right? Can you talk about Walter Duranty and his reporting on Stalinism and what happened there?
Yeah, so Duranty was reporting in the early 1930s. He was the New York Times' Russia correspondent. He was a British guy. And he was a very good reporter. He was a very smart man and a great writer. And in 1932, there started to be reports around Russia and the Ukraine of a famine, of a major famine. And a lot of Western reporters were reporting that indeed there was this devastating famine unfolding in the Ukraine specifically. And Walter Duranty, again, the most powerful and most influential of all foreign correspondents, because he worked for the New York Times, it's not that he even downplayed it, he actively denied it. And he would go so far as to sort of chisel away at the reporting of other people who said this was taking place. So the New York Times, you know, we have to ask ourselves the questions, why would Walter Duranty, as a journalist, want to pass up the story of a lifetime? you know, people can say, oh, he had his own reasons, but there are no reasons if you're an ambitious journalist like him to give up a great scoop like that when we know it was taking place and he knew it was taking place too. And the answer to that question, this is what's something that nobody really focuses on when we talk about Walter Duranty, as infamous as he is it wasn't him who made that decision. It was his bosses at the New York Times. And the reason for that, again, it comes back to interest. It comes back to the fact that the New York Times and the owners of the New York Times were very tied up with the most powerful business people in America at that time. And this group of business people wanted access to this gigantic Russian market that was quickly industrializing. They were getting it was becoming an even more powerful market than it had been. We're talking 150 million people. And there was because of the industrialization, there was more and more need for the kind of resources that the US could export at the time. And this group of business people wanted the US to formally, officially recognize the Soviet Union so they could establish these trade ties. But you're not going to convince the American people to recognize this new regime, the new Soviet regime, if that regime had just killed 3 million of its own people with a deliberate famine that Stalin had perpetrated as a way to consolidate power. So you have Walter Duranty tapped to kind of carry this huge amount of water for these business people, for these interests. And that's exactly what he did. He made it seem as if there was no such thing as a famine in the Ukraine. And the American public reading the New York Times and all the other editors of all the other newspapers out there taking that lead printed the same kinds of stories. And then lo and behold, in 1934, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he goes through with the official recognition of the Soviet Union by the American government. And at a gala event at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, attended by 1,500 people, which included the head of Ford Motors, the head of GM, the head of GE, the head of Chase, the head of JP Morgan, the head of multiple railroads, Walter Duranty is the only person to receive a standing ovation that night, because it was really what he did that made that recognition of the Soviet Union possible.
Right. And I mean, a lot of these guys, and you'll see this theme in your book, they're maybe not telling the full truth. A lot of them got Pulitzer Prizes. So Duranty was recognized as that. And you also talk was interesting about the allowance of kind of official Soviet propagandists or spies also involved. Can you talk a little bit about their kind of infiltration into reporting?
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com. For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Yeah, the time, you know, if you were just an average reader of the New York Times, curious at that historical moment about what was this new Soviet thing. I mean, at the time Duranty was reporting on not reporting on the famine, the Soviet Union was only 15, 16 years old. It was still pretty young in its life cycle. And people were trying to understand what this was. What did it mean that you had this new communist country? The world had never really seen such a thing. And if you were to read the New York Times, you would think it was sort of a wonderland, a utopia. with the kind of stuff that they were reporting. And they went so far to, whether or not they knew that this person was a communist agent, her name was Ella Winter, but they ran her reporting about how wonderful it was in the new Soviet Union as if they were news stories, whereas this woman was working for the Soviet propaganda master, Willy Munzenberg, and she was printing outright propaganda for years on end as a New York Times reporter, contributor. And that was absolutely not an isolated case. I mean, you had again and again and again people running New York Times stories, reporters or contributors, some of them very famous, coming with this same message that the Soviet Union is all but perfect, that the streets are sort of filled with people, you know, dancing with joy, where the reality was exactly the opposite. It was harsh. There was, you know, systematic murder of Stalin's political enemies, and even not his political enemies, just anyone who happened to get caught up in that. There was a drastic shortage of foods and generally of goods. And then there was things like the Ukraine famine, which is the deaths of up to, the estimate today is around possibly up to 5 million people, maybe even more, which was perpetrated by Stalin in those 2 years. I mean, that is something that is really mind-blowing when you zoom out and think about that. 5 million people, even if it was 2 or 3 million people in 2 years, is crazy when you know, we think about the Holocaust and all the deaths that were perpetrated, the murders that were perpetrated then. This was something of that magnitude. And again, the New York Times, it's not that they just didn't report on the famine. It's that they reported that this Soviet Union was a wonderful place to be.
Right. And that was like a common theme. A lot of that, they call it in Ukraine the Holodomor. So they kind of have their own name for this mass death event. But a lot of that was covered up. And the New York Times played definitely a role in keeping a lot of the stories from the American public and also putting this kind of gilded coating over the Soviet Union and not accepting some of their crimes. So it's they definitely were part of that. But their kind of reporting, I think you see a little bit of a left-leaning there, also applies to kind of Fidel Castro and the New York Times and how they viewed his ascension to power. I think maybe even similar to what happened in the Soviet Union. Can you talk about the New York Times and how they perceived Fidel Castro?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was another real big scandal in not just the history of the New York Times, but really in the history of the world. Because, you know, if we think about Fidel Castro, this guy had a major impact on geopolitics, the Cuban Missile Crisis, putting nuclear weapons in America's backyard because he was in control there and he was an avowed communist. But when the New York Times reporter who went to seek him out back in the late 1950s went to Cuba, into the mountains of Cuba to find him, Fidel Castro was really a nobody. He was all but failed as a rebel. He had very few men left with him. He had no money. He had almost no arms, no weapons. And he was just kind of hiding out in these mountains. And the Batista government at the time that was in control in Cuba had really even just kind of stopped looking for him because they didn't consider him a threat. But then this New York Times reporter by the name of Herbert Matthews wants to go out and find this guy, and he does. And he writes this front page story about Fidel Castro that makes him out to be this democratic messiah. I mean, he writes about him, Castro, in the strongest, most adulatory terms, and just builds him up to the point that almost overnight, there was an inflow of all the things Castro really needed: money, guns, men to fight. But the most important thing of all was that kind of attention. There was the spotlight. That's what he really needed, to be seen as this thing, to be seen as this great figure, this democratic savior of the island of Cuba, when, of course, that was absolutely not true. There was nothing to suggest that Castro would ever be democratic. And even well into the revolution, once he had overthrown Batista, the Times still continued to push this notion that Castro was this democratic guy. He was all for the people. Didn't matter that he didn't let them vote, because the people were so convinced of his greatness that they didn't need to vote. That's really what the New York Times was telling people. And at the end of the day, what happened was the Cuban people ended up with a dictator and still have that same dictatorship 50 years later. And it really was because of the New York Times' massive coverage of Castro and that kind of rose-tinted glasses that they presented him through.
Right. So this one character, Herbert Matthews, is very smart, very good writer. So he can adjust things. And he writes this headlines in the New York Times, Cuba, first step to a new era. So they're definitely propping him up. And then he just becomes a dictator, really runs everything. And a lot of people got shot. They don't really talk about that, but they ran a lot, almost somewhat Stalinistic in a way. But a lot of his opponents got shot.
Oh yeah.
Talk about the Hubert Matos incident. So there's a lot of things that contradicted really what the New York Times was saying, which Castro was doing. When you talk about the lukewarm lemonade incident, can you chat about that or address that?
That was the kind of thing that that really shows you how the international left saw Cuba. And the story there is that two of the international left at the time's biggest celebrities, which was Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, they were in Cuba to interview Castro, walking along some beach with him somewhere, and there's a little lemonade stand. And Castro says, let's go grab a lemonade, a cold lemonade on a hot day. And he gets the lemonade, he takes a sip, it's not cold, it's lukewarm. And he said, what's going on here? Why is this not cold? And the seller says, well, because the refrigerator broke down. And Castro says, we'll get it fixed. And the person says, well, we tried that, but we can't. So Castro says, you know, if you can't get it fixed, you tell your boss, because otherwise he's going to have problems with me. And in the eyes of Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, this was an instance of how great he was as a democratic leader. He had this sort of relationship with this small person, this seller of lemonade, and he didn't, you know, it was like a direct democracy was the term that they like to use. He didn't even need to be the big leader. He could just be on the ground. And really, when you take a step back and think about what was really going on there, he was threatening a lemonade seller because they didn't have a cold lemonade for him. And that's something that's, you know, obviously no democratic leader is going to make a threat to someone because the lemonade wasn't cold. But these people really saw this as something that was proof of Castro's democratic nature. And that was really representative of how the New York Times thought of him too.
Right. And you said that he was thankful. You say Guevara and Castro were thankful to Sulzberger and the New York Times, right?
Yeah, Castro sort of did a pilgrimage to the New York Times building on Times Square at that era. Not once, not even twice, three times. He went to shake the hand of the New York Times' publisher and to say thank you for all the publisher and the New York Times had done for him, because he was very aware of what that meant. He was aware that the New York Times' coverage of him in the late 1950s and even in the early 60s was the difference between success and failure for him as a leader, as a dictator.
Right, and I think this is a quote from your book. It's by Che Guevara, which is, Matthews' work was more important to the rebels than a victory on the battlefield. So it shows the import and the impact of the New York Times as the newspaper of record. And I think, there's a lot more in your book. You cover Vietnam. You talk about the different reporting in Hiroshima and the Middle East. I mean, there's some really interesting things that I didn't really know about the Jamal and Muhammad al-Dura incident. But maybe we could talk a little bit about that. And can you address that from your perspective of what happened in that chapter you titled Mideast Martyr?
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Yeah, so you know that was something that happened at the very beginning of the Second Intifada, and this would have been around September of 2000, where things were starting to get really hot in Israel between Israel and the Palestinians, And one day, this man named Jamal al-Dura took his son, Muhammad al-Dura, to go, this is the story at least, to go look for a used car, which, you know, it was a bit of a strange kind of thing to do because all the major checkpoints were closed, all the junctions were closed. There was a strike at the time, so things wouldn't have been open, but that's apparently what he was there to do. So he gets to this junction in Israel where there was this battle underway between Israeli forces and Palestinians, and they took a taxi, they get out of the taxi and they have to take cover against a cement wall, and there's like a concrete barrier next to them. And there's some footage, some video footage of this event, you see the two of them, father and son, cowering behind this barrier. And then sort of at one point, the boy slumps over and is, you know, according to the narration in the video, is now been shot dead. And the narration is saying that it was Israeli forces that shot him. And this is something the New York Times picked up on pretty much the next day. And they said not only that the boy was killed and that he was killed by the Israeli soldiers, but that his killing by these Israeli soldiers made him into a quote unquote a symbol of the conflict. This was before any investigation had been conducted. There was no New York Times reporter present at that scene that day. There was actually no Western reporter present that day. The narration was by a French reporter who himself was not present there. He had just kind of taken it as hearsay of what had happened. So
it was a very powerful image that got distributed all around the world and was supposedly initially, like, it was a sign that the Israelis did it, but yeah, please continue.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, actually, because that image was the symbol that they were talking about just days after the event took place. And that's really what this was all about, the creation of a symbol. And that symbol was one of Israeli aggression and Palestinian victimhood. It was very, very clear. But there were a lot of gaps in that story. There was parts of the footage that had went missing. There were questions about why the French reporter was narrating this footage if he wasn't there to actually having reported it himself. He was just sort of assuming that what he'd been told was the truth. And the story that unfolds is that there were multiple investigations that took place. One was an Israeli investigation, which they found the exact same kind of concrete barrier that was there. It was an Israeli concrete barrier. And they tried to fire through it from that position. And they found that they could not fire through it with the same weapons, which was probably an M16. But, you know, that was sort of discounted because it was an Israeli investigation. Years later, there was a libel lawsuit in France related to this case. And a French forensics and ballistics expert examined this evidence. And his finding, and this was a third party who had no interest in the conflict whatsoever, he found that, in his words, there was no possible way that, given where the Israelis were, that they could have shot this boy, let alone killed him. But this already, between then, the incident itself and the later finding that there was no way the Israelis had killed him, the New York Times had basically reported for months and months and months that this boy was murdered by Israeli soldiers, and that he had now become a symbol of this conflict. And he had become such a symbol that he was used by Islamist terrorists around the world as justification for their crimes, including for the murder of an American reporter, American Wall Street Journal reporter named Daniel Pearl.
Pearl, right.
So, yeah. You know, this was the kind of thing that they perpetrated. And once that French report came out, they never corrected it. They never returned to the issue. They just kept their silence.
Right. It's very advantageous. And so the New York Times is involved. They never seem to really say they're sorry. And there's not a lot of retrospective analysis, it seems like, with the New York Times. But Claude Schlesinger actually said it is very possible that this is a case where the incident was staged. So there was definitely a high propaganda piece. And it seems like the New York Times really took that position. But talking about propaganda, we go to, I mean, the woke history. I think that really the New York Times is really involved in this 1619 project, and you have a great chapter on that, super timely. Can you talk about what the New York Times did with the 1619 project and what the response was in the kind of intelligentsia world?
Yeah, definitely. This to, you know, I think as we're all seeing this flare up about critical race theory and woke, so-called woke ideology, You know, you can trace so much of it back to the times, and with the 1619 project, which is this, it extends even beyond the borders of the newspaper itself into podcasts and educational curricula. But the main thrust of it is to say that America was actually not founded in 1776, which was the basis of American liberty. Rather, it was founded in 1619, which is when they think that the first slaves arrived in the colony. And what they were trying to say with this, the New York Times and the creators of the 1619 Project, was that America was not founded in liberty and rooted in freedom, but in slavery, in human bondage. And they've traced every social, economic, and political force in American life and public life today to slavery. So what they're saying is that in all ways, but the most technical, it's still sort of a slaveocracy. And that's really, they're pushing this very radical, extreme notion. But the real thing in my mind, the real kicker here is that in order to make this sort of backwards case about American, upside down case about American history, you really have to distort the truth. Because when you look at the actual facts that historians know to be as close to the truth as we can get, they don't agree with that narrative. They don't agree with the notion, as the New York Times has reported, that the American Revolutionary War was fought to preserve slavery. That's a claim the 1619 Project makes. And historians, including ones that the Times used as its fact checkers, have come out and said, there's just no way you can even stretch that interpretation to make that even remotely true. And that's a major historical claim among many others that they got completely wrong. And people came out afterwards, after this was published, on the left, this was, you know, it was real accepted and celebrated with a lot of fanfare. But a lot of these historians from the left as well, by the way, the right and the left, came out and said, this stuff is just not true. It's not accurate. It's wrong. It's erroneous. And when I went back and looked through this, what I came to understand and what I show in the chapter on the 1619 Project is that these were not mistakes at all. They were deliberate distortions of history, because if you really are trying to change history, you literally have to change it. And that's exactly what they did. They printed these claims. People can now accept them as truth, including in schools where the 1619 Project is being taught. And that's a very, very dangerous thing to do.
And you, when they first came out with it, you said that, like, they spent the New York Times really came out big, a very expensive program. You said that very sophisticated, very stylish. So they really put a real impetus to get this out into the public. And I mean, it really did kind of create kind of this explosion, like people definitely responded to it. But it's interesting that's there. And has the New York Times tried to retract that? I don't think they have they?
No, they've really stood behind most of those claims. They have responded. There was an editor's letter from the New York Times Magazine, sort of, you know, doubling down on a lot of this stuff and saying that, you know, some of it that we never really claimed this, and some of it that, you know, it is actually true. But a lot of it they have not retracted. Definitely the majority of it they have not retracted. Maybe there's one or two small claims, but, you know, one of the biggest.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Incidents related to this project is that a historian of African-American history and slavery from Northwestern University came out and said she heard the woman who created the 1619 Project, the New York Times reporter named Nicole Hannah Jones, make claims that this historian had specifically told the New York Times were not true. They just reported them anyway as if they were true. And that's where I said to myself, This was always deliberate. These were not simple errors. So they were never going to correct things that they didn't see as errors. They just see it as a revising of American history to better suit the needs of their ideology. And that's exactly what the 1619 Project is. And that's what it's continuing to do today, because it wasn't just a magazine issue. It was this multi-platform campaign that will probably extend for many years.
Right. So, I mean, it's really important. But yeah, you're right. They knowingly are deceptive about certain things in that project. But yeah, it's really incredible. Guys, I highly recommend this book. Again, the title is The Gray Lady Winked: How the New York Times' Misreporting, Distortions, and Fabrications Radically Alter History. Where's the best place for people to get this book? And did you have any social media where people can contact you?
Yeah, definitely. Amazon is a good place to get it. Barnes & Noble, Book Depository. You can find me on Twitter. If you look up the book on Amazon, you'll find my name, Ashley Rinsberg. That's my handle on Twitter. That's a good place to interact with me with questions. I try to do my best to respond to all the stuff that comes up there, because these are interesting conversations. So yeah, that's where you can find me.
Is there anything you'd like to add or anything I missed before we wrap it up?
I think the big point here is that we're really at a turning point for media, and that people are starting to be aware that what we've accepted as gospel truth for so long from these big institutions, we're not really accepting the truth anymore. And lab leak with COVID-19 is a great example, where the New York Times itself participated in covering up that China might have leaked COVID-19 from its lab in Wuhan. And now people are asking their own questions and searching for their own facts. And I think that's a really healthy development in how we understand not just the news, but the reality around us. So I think that that's a really important thing. And I think that's the part of this book, is to say, yes, that we need to stop just accepting what these institutions tell us as the God-given truth, and start asking our own questions and searching for our own truth and our own corroboration of the truth, wherever we find it.
Totally agree. Excellent book. Very well done. Highly recommended. Guys, go get this book. Again, it's The Gray Lady Winked: How the New York Times' Misreporting, Distortions, and Fabrications Radically Alter History, by Ashley Rinsberg. Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you so much, William.
All right.